welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, we'll hear about the day the screen screamed on memoirs of the movies from 1959. But right now, a broadcast of The Cavalcade of America, penned by Leatherstocking Tales author James Fenimore Cooper, called Enoch Crosby the Spy, from February 27, 1940, on the NBC Blue Network.
By DuPont. The story of Enoch Crosby, the spy. Starring the noted American actor Henry Hull as Enoch Crosby. The DuPont Company, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, tonight brings you a story of personal sacrifice and unselfish heroism, of one man's devotion and loyalty to the cause of freedom. The story of Enoch Crosby, a spy of the American Revolution. It is the year 1820 in the town of Bedford, New York. On a shaded porch, two men sit with their pipes and wine in the late afternoon. The younger is James Fenimore Cooper. The elder is a former president of the Continental Congress and the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Jay.
Mr. Jay, did you ever have a plague of critics fighting you?
You mean this novel you've written, James?
Yes, sir. Have you read it?
Certainly. Well, it seems to me we've had enough books about European fopperies. Why don't you write a novel about America, James?
Perhaps I might, sir, if I had a proper subject.
Proper subject? Why, America's full of them. Yeah, I can tell you a story of one man who helped make our country free.
I'd like to hear it, Mr. Jay.
Well, this man was a shoemaker. The British were in New York, the Americans in retreat. Westchester County, in between, was the neutral ground.
When was this, sir?
It was the year 1776. I was a member of the Committee of Safety, meeting at Fishkill. We met with General Washington at his headquarters. He'd summoned us there for a conversation on the difficulties which faced our cause in the state of New York.
Gentlemen, many things are happening before we know it. We need a type of spy this war hasn't seen yet.
What do you mean, General Washington?
We need someone, some man, who loves our cause so completely, he'd be willing to masquerade as a British spy to get us the right information and give them misleading reports of our plan. It is the duty of your committee to find such a man.
Very well, General Washington.
We'll be asking someone to do a thankless task, Mr. Jay. But you and I know it is a necessary one. His identity must be a secret between us. But remember, the very success of our cause may depend on that man.
James Young, Mr. Jay.
Young? What do you want this time of night?
I've got to see you, Mr. Jay. I brought a friend with important news.
All right, wait. I'll be right down.
Better see after the horses, Crosby.
I hit some under a tree over there. They'll be all right. Step inside out of the rain, Young, while I light a lamp. Now, what is it?
Mr. Jay, this man is Enoch Crosby. He has information for your committee.
Good, good. What is it, Mr. Crosby? Mr. Jay, I know of a company of Tories being recruited not an hour's ride from here.
Well, who are they? Do you know their names?
I got all their names written out right here and the time and place of their next meeting.
Well, sit down, Mr. Crosby. Sit down. Tell me your story from the beginning.
Well, sir, you see, I'm a shoemaker by trade, but I was on my way to enlist. When I was going through Elizabethtown, I fell in with a traveler who mistook me for a Tory.
I take it he was one himself.
Precisely, sir, a blasted Tory. But I stayed with him in his home for 3 days until I had all the names and facts.
Good for you.
Then I persuaded him that I was so eager to join the British, I'd go on ahead of them. But instead, I came here to Mr. Young, and then he brought me here tonight. Here. Here's the list.
Yes, yes. Everything seems complete. Young, will you go to Mr. Dewar's, tell him I sent you, and urge him to hasten here with the other committee members?
Yes, sir. I'll be glad to do whatever you say. I'll have them all here as quick as I can, Mr. Jay.
Well, I wish we could discover more or all their plans as easily, Crosby.
Oh, we could, huh? I'm sure we could, sir.
And it would be a dangerous course for any man, Crosby.
Well, a man would have to be sharp, it's true. But if a man's business was plausible, he might deceive him.
If he was, say, an itinerant shoemaker?
Oh, yeah, perhaps you're right, Mr. Jay. Yeah, I did it this one time. I could do it again, I reckon.
If you succeed, Crosby, you'll deserve more credit than you'll ever get. But if you fail, well...
I know. I'd be a spy. Is that it?
That is it, Crosby. If you're ever caught by the British, we can do nothing for you. Absolutely nothing.
Then I'll see to it that the redcoats never catch me.
But the Americans themselves may catch you.
Oh, but couldn't I set them right quick enough?
No, Crosby, you could not. And be of any use to our cause.
Oh? Yeah, I see.
Now, do you still want to be a spy?
Yes, Mr. Jay, I do. And I'll risk my life for it.
Harcourt?
Yes?
There's a shoemaker outside who wishes to see you.
Shoemaker? Well, I have no time for a shoemaker today, Lieutenant.
He says he has certain information of the rebels you may find interesting, sir.
They all have information. It's all worthless. What's his name? Where's he from?
Name is Crosby, he says. He's just come from White Plains.
Well, send him in. If he kept his eyes open at White Plains, he may be worth our while.
Yes, sir. Colonel
Harcourt
will see you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Well, Colonel Harcourt, how'd you do?
Well, come in, Crosby. Come in. I say, you needn't bow so low as all that.
Oh, I'm bowing, sir. Well, not rightly, but you see, I'm a shoemaker by trade, and I always like to see good boots on a man.
Suppose we forget boots for the moment, Crosby, and hear the news of the rebels. You come from White Plains, I understand.
Yes, sir. And speaking of the rebels, none of them have got boots to compare to yours. Not even General George Washington himself.
Indeed. You mean to tell me you're his cobbler?
I get around, Colonel. And when you know a man's boots, you know the man pretty well, I always say. Now you take General Lincoln's boots.
Come, Crosby. I want to know of the strength of the rebels at White Plains. If you can tell me, do so. If you can't, be gone.
If I do, will you let me make your next boot, sir?
Yes. Yes, we can arrange something, Crosby. Now, what of White Plains?
Why, it was just as I started to tell you, sir. General Lincoln took himself and his boots away from White Plains this morning. And there's only a company of foot.
Just a minute, Crosby. Lieutenant.
Yes, sir?
Step up here to the desk a moment. Oh, Crosby, some of my boots are in that cabinet over there. Take a look at them. They'll give you an idea of my style better than these I'm wearing.
Yes, sir. Very well. I certainly will, sir.
Lieutenant, the fool's told us more than he realizes. There's only one company of foot soldiers at White Plains. We can strike there Sunday and catch these hymn-singing rebels away from their muskets.
Katie, father,
Enoch,
Katie, what are you doing here?
Enoch, my darling, you're home.
Katie, what are you doing here this time of night?
Not so loud, Enoch, you'll wake your father. I just got him comfortable.
Father? Is he ill?
Sick with worrying over you. And I'm worried, too, Enoch. Oh, I've missed you. I'm so glad you're back with me now. Oh, don't leave again.
Oh, now, please, 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 Kate, let's not talk about that.
Enoch, everybody's wondering which cause you work for.
My cause, Katie? Well, my only cause is shoemaking.
People don't think so, Enoch. They say you're a Tory spy and that you must have been sorry when the British were beaten at White Plains. They're saying you've been paid British gold and it's a wonder the Skinners haven't robbed you long ago. Oh, those Skinners, Enoch. They're robbing practically everybody, and I'm afraid for you.
Katie, do you believe all this about me?
I must believe some of it, Enoch. I know there's a price on your head. And I know Captain Townsend says he'll hang you on sight. Oh, Enoch, don't you see what's going to happen to you? Give it up.
Listen, who's that?
Hide quickly, Enoch, and I'll see. Maybe the Skinners. Yes, it is the Robin Skinners, Enoch. Hide. I'll get them to go away.
No, they'd find me, Katie.
But, Enoch, I don't care what you've done. Hide.
I might as well.
Please.
Open up, or we'll break down the door.
Open up, Tossie. We know you're in there.
Take it in there. Here he is, ma'am. There's our quarry, the shoemaker's spy.
Skinners, robbers, get out of this house.
Not before we've done what we come to do.
Please, be quiet, will you? My father's asleep in the next room.
Oh, we care not for an old man. Where's your money, Crosby?
He has no gold.
Now, be quiet, Katie Haynes. He has gold, sure enough, the king's gold. And King George is a good paymaster, I'm told.
Enoch, please, what's the matter?
Please, my father's sick. If I give you what gold I have, will you go?
Well, now, Crosby, you show it to us and we'll see.
Yeah, you go lift the cornerstone over there, the hearth. Yeah. You'll find it. Well, all I've got.
Hurry up, lad.
All right. Come
here. What is it there?
Well, it's little gold.
Well, I tell you, it's all I've got. The little I make is a cobbler. Now, will you go?
I get along with you. Leave us alone.
Wait. Just a moment, lad. We've got some of the gold. Now we want the rest. We want you, Crosby.
What?
Take your hands off him, you cutthroat.
Oh, keep quiet, wench. You come along with us, Crosby.
I don't.
It's 50 guineas reward for you. We're taking you to Captain Townsend of the Continental Army.
No, let go of me. Take your hands.
Come on, we said, Crosby. We're taking you to Townsend for the reward. 50 guineas.
Well, Crosby, you're my prisoner at last.
Well, no dispute in that point, Captain Townsend.
Nor this, Crosby. I'm charging you with treason. You're a spy. I've sworn publicly to have you hanged on sight.
I heard you promise that.
You heard correctly.
Nothing could make you change your mind?
Nothing.
Well, have I no right of appeal?
You can appeal to General Washington if you like, but it'll do you no good.
Well, it would do me no harm. And it would give me a few days.
Very well, Crosby. But I advise you to put no store in it. I promise you, you'll hang.
Washington?
Oh, yes. What is it, Colonel?
Orders of the day, sir.
Very well. What are they?
A reply to the Poughkeepsie commander, sir. He's been promised reinforcement for his garrison.
Yes, I remember. Is that all?
There's the matter of the spy captured by Captain Townsend. He urges that you confirm the sentence of hanging. Shall I attend to it, sir?
Yes, take care of it.
Very good, sir.
At once.
Just a moment, Colonel. That last matter, who is this spy?
He goes by the name of Enoch Crosby, notoriously in communication with the enemy.
Crosby.
Yes, sir.
I think I'll hold up his sentence.
But, sir, this spy hasn't offered even the shadow of a defense.
Nevertheless, I'm withholding my confirmation for the time being. As you say, he's in communication with the enemy. Suppose he escaped.
Escaped? Why? Sir, I don't understand.
Well, there are some things a lot of us don't understand, Colonel. In this case, I must ask you to carry out my orders without question.
Yes, sir.
I want you to see to it that Crosby escapes with information for him to deliver to the British. Information that would lead Sir Henry Clinton to hold his troops in New York, leaving Cornwallis unprotected at Yorktown. Then we will strike at Yorktown, and God willing, we'll win the war.
I'll give the order for Crosby's release at once.
No. No, not release him, Colonel. We must permit him to escape, secretly. Find his wife or his sweetheart. He must have one or the other. Use her to effect his escape.
I'll see to that, General Washington. Do so, and remember, Colonel, it must appear that we've been caught napping and a prisoner spy escaped us. But we'll be very wide awake at Yorktown.
Bye, Judas, that's good.
I tell you, dear, those are the very words General Washington said to Colonel Hamilton. I heard them myself.
Well, I never would have believed it. Then the general, just like you and me, Colonel.
Why, of course he is. He'd be as good a jailer as you or I. You should know him as I do.
Well, say, now what would he do with that spy, Crosby, we got in the jail here?
He's a general, isn't he? He knows the fortunes of war.
You mean the misfortune of the rope. That's the fate of a spy.
What's that?
Who's out there?
Open the door.
You hear that? It's a woman this time of night. Who is it?
It's me, Katie Haynes.
Oh, sure, Katie Haynes. She has a bright eye for Crosby in there. Well, what'll I do?
Oh, let her in. Where's the harm in a pretty face ever so often?
Well, right you are. Come in, Katie.
Thank you, sir.
Good evening.
Wait, now. What have you in that sack?
It's Enoch Shoemaker's sack with food in it. To make up for what you don't give him to eat.
Now, let me see what you've got there. Open it up, Katie.
All right. Now, there you are. There's some food for the poor man. And a fresh noggin of wine for you to warm your bones with this sharp knife.
You hear that, my friend? Wine. That's good of you, Katie.
I knew you'd be letting me see him for the wine. You're both fine gentlemen. You'll not be denying me.
Not me. I'm in no mood to deny anyone, especially a wench with a wild, beautiful face like yours, lass. Hey, jailer?
Aye. I'll be drinking your health, Katie Haynes. Go on in with you, pretty.
Thank you. And God's grace to you both. I'll not be staying long.
Second door on your right. You'll find Crosby there, Katie, waiting for you.
Aye, I hope so. Enoch.
Katie, my darling.
Oh, it's good to see you, Enoch. I've some food here.
Come out for a breath of air, jailer. I have something to tell you. Never mind, your prisoner's all right. He's in good company.
Night air will do me good. I'm coming.
Enoch, quick.
Yes, what is it, Katie?
The tall one, not the jailer.
Well, who is he? He don't belong here. First time ever I've seen him around the jail.
He's from headquarters, Enoch. He gave me this parcel for you. There are papers in it you're supposed to read. Your instructions.
Why, instructions for what?
That man's here to see that you escape tonight, and I'm to help.
Escape? Now?
No. You're to go quickly when the jailer drops off to sleep.
He never sleeps. He stays awake all night.
You won't tonight. Not after he drinks that wine I drugged.
Oh.
I tell you, Rawlings, we've got to get some information somehow. Sir Henry Clinton is frantic. The situation is desperate.
Yes, I wish we could get hold of that shoemaker. Maybe he could tell us something.
Oh, Crosby, it's all up with our spy. The rebels have him with a rope around his neck.
I wish we knew what those rabbling rags are planning to do next.
Yes, what is it?
The man's out here to see you, Colonel.
I'm busy. He said to tell you it was the shoemaker.
Crosby escaped. More lives than a dozen cats. We better see him, sir.
Naturally. Have him come in, orderly.
Yes, sir. Colonel Harker will see you.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning.
Crosby, we thought we'd never see you upright again. What happened, man?
A fellow like me's got a gleam in his eye for the girls. And there's always one that catches it. And rather than see me swing, she won't be stopping a drug in a jailer either. And I walked out with a lot of news I've heard in the rebel camp.
News? What news, Crosby?
You wait, you hear.
We'll finish with you, my lad, where the rebels didn't, if it isn't the kind of news we want to hear.
You want to hear it, all right, Colonel.
But come, man, out with it.
All right, then. Now, listen. It's this. The rebels are planning to attack New York.
New York? Excellent, Crosby, excellent. This will certainly give Sir Henry Clinton enough time to prepare a proper reception. What a fatal error it would have been to have sent reinforcements to Cornwallis in Virginia. I knew it. Our cause will win, Crosby.
Oh, I always knew that, Colonel. You're right, sir. Our cause will win, all right, all right.
October 19th, 1781. The headquarters of General Washington at Yorktown, Virginia. The cause had won. Gentlemen, gentlemen, one more cup before we go out to the parade ground.
Yes,
to our glorious victory.
Just a moment, Colonel Hamilton. To General Washington, our commander, and the eternal memory of this day here at Yorktown.
General Washington.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. General Lafayette, may I call your attention to the music? Perhaps you and France are not acquainted with the brave old tune. The world turned upside down.
Well, it certainly turned our world right side up. Well,
may it ever remain so. Shall we go, gentlemen?
Come in.
A message from Lord Cornwallis, General Washington. He will not be able to present his sword to you this day. He's suddenly been taken ill. He has instructed General O'Hara to deliver his sword to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ill. He's as healthy as a bull.
There's an insult to you, General Washington, in this sudden illness.
It's not my Lord Cornwallis that surrenders. It's his sword, a symbol of British defeat. We have one gentleman, and that's all that matters. General Lincoln, will you receive Lord Cornwallis' sword in my name?
In your name, yes, I will, General Washington.
Attention!
General O'Hara, I have the honor of representing General Washington.
It is my Lord Cornwallis' sword, General Lincoln, in token of his surrender.
Good day, sir. You keep your appointment, Mr. J.
This is our last meeting, Mr. Crosby. The war is over.
Yes. I suppose you must be right, sir. We won at Yorktown, and now America's free. So am I. Free once more to go with my head up among my neighbors.
Can you do that now or ever, Crosby?
I don't know. Can't I, Mr. J.? But I've been a spy. They've always thought I was a spy. A Tory spy. Would they change their opinion now?
It's hard to overcome suspicion, Crosby. Your neighbors don't know that you never betrayed information to the enemy unless we authorized you. We know what you've done, Crosby, but I doubt if your neighbors will ever understand. You've made a great sacrifice. And you've done your country a noble service.
That's reward enough, sir. Thank you.
I can do a little more. I can now pay you in part for that service. This isn't much, but it may help you to start again.
No. Thank you, sir, but no. Now, what I did, I didn't do for money, but to serve our country, as you and General Washington did.
But, Crosby, our situations are different. We have gained some honor, but you have gained only the reputation of a traitor to America. And you may go to your grave with that reputation. Is there nothing I can do for you?
Well, just give me your hand, sir, as you have given me your friendship. No matter what people will think of me, I'll always try to remember that no sacrifice, no matter if it's a lifelong one, is ever too great to ask of any man in the service of his country. Well, goodbye, sir. Come on, boy. Come on, get along, boy. Get along, man. Goodbye!
The story of Enoch Crosby, a story told a young American author, James Fenimore Cooper, by an aging jurist, patriot, and American statesman, John Jay. It was that same author, Cooper, who immortalized this story in the first truly American novel, The Spy. The adventures were similar,
The name was not. Americans know The Spy as the story of one Harvey Birch. In reality, the hero of The Spy is Enid Crosby. For among the unheralded facts of American history, the name and story of the Revolutionary War shoemaker, patriot, and spy Enid Crosby is secure. And tonight, he takes an honored place in the cavalcade of America. Thank you, Henry Hull. We're happy to have had you as our guest on The Cavalcade of America.
The Cavalcade of America on Tuned to Yesterday, a broadcast from February 27th, 1940, on the NBC Blue Network. That story, Enid Crosby the Spy, penned by James Fenimore Cooper, whose series The Deerslayer, The Last of the Mohicans, and Destiny Trails were all adapted during radio's yesteryear for the year. And the story we just heard was heard again on the Family Theater in 1950. You're listening to An Hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for Memoirs of the Movies, a syndicated broadcast from 1959, hosted by actress Myrna Loy. It's the episode called The Day the Screen Screamed.
Memoirs of the Movies, an 18-part series of recollections of the world of Hollywood, produced in cooperation with the Oral History Research Project of Columbia University. In 1927, Al Jolson spoke, and the movie business was never the same again. The subject of our program this evening, The Day the Screen Screamed. Here is our hostess on these programs, Miss Myrna Loy.
Thank you. Perhaps there are people listening in who have never seen a really distinguished silent film. Many of them were exquisitely beautiful to watch because the photography was superb. They had a dreamy fairy tale quality all their own. I made a few silent pictures, and I suppose the acting was primitive by today's standards. But we did try very hard to do something more than just the obvious cliches of pantomime. Actually, we learned lines to say on the screen, although the audience couldn't hear them. Then in 1927, the technical people succeeded in printing a soundtrack right on the film, first for music and then for actual spoken dialogue. It was, to put it mildly, a bombshell. Most of the actors were sincerely terrified. Some went on the radio to prove that they could talk. Some hired voice coaches. Some went into seclusion. And some, well, some just faded away and dropped out of sight. The personal recollections you're about to hear were recorded in 1959. Since then, the voices of Richard Barthelmess, Harold Lloyd, and Reginald Denny have been stilled. So has the voice of Joseph Schildkraut, a distinguished Viennese actor. But here he is to recall the day the screen screamed.
This is Joseph Schildkraut speaking. Well, I remember the movies the way they used to be, do you? Do you remember these words spoken by a great popular singer back in
1927? Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Yes, that was Al Jolson, improvising the first line of dialogue ever spoken on the motion picture screen in The Jazz Singer. Now, that moment when the actors first began to talk to each other and to you, the audience, was it a great step forward in motion picture history, or does it just seem that way in retrospect? You know, it's hard to believe today that motion picture producers were most reluctant to accept sound movies. Seems so simple today, doesn't it? But if you've seen a great many silents, you may recall that in those early days, people said they went to the movies to relax, not to be shouted at. And they felt dialogue would spoil the communication between the actors and the audience. Besides, the theaters had no sound equipment until Mr. Sam Warner of Warner Brothers convinced his brother Harry that sound was feasible. A personal recollection of that famous occasion by Mr. Albert Housen after 32 years with Warner Brothers.
They showed it to Sam Warner. Sam was the first one to see it. And
He was very much impressed with the possibilities.
Yeah, Mr. Harry Warner told me this himself. He said Sam came to retirement again. So I've seen some things, and he didn't tell me what it was. And I finally, to get rid of him, I said, all right, take me there, let me see it, and have done with it. And having reached the place, I saw this little 4 or 5-piece jazz band on the screen playing. I heard the music. He said I was the smartest boy in the room. I got up on my feet quietly and walked around behind the screen to see where the band was, and there wasn't any band. Mr. Warren was impressed by having seen and heard this device, and therefore plunged into the thing with all his resources and brought it to a point of least stability, not perfection, of course, because that has taken years to acquire. First, your sound was recorded on discs similar to phonographic discs, and your film was started on a given starting mark, your disc on a given starting mark on a turntable attached to the projection machine, and when the machine started, they both started, and thereby we obtained synchronization. It took a long time to accustom the ordinary projectionist to this new method of procedure. The results sometimes were disastrous.
Financially, sound photography and projection were a tremendous undertaking. Artistically, there were just as many problems. Director King Vidor recalls his reluctance to begin work on an all-talking feature, Hallelujah, a drama of the New South and an early sound classic.
We found that, for example, in making, reproducing Hallelujah, well, one of the first dialogue scenes I made with sound was with the Negroes on the docks playing in a crap game. And we had to say how much they were shooting, and we had to get into all the figures of $2 or $2.50 and 25 cents and all that. And this struck me as rather pinning it down. I didn't want to say how much they were shooting. It's just the same as in a love scene. The man had to say, I love you. I will always love you. I love you better than anyone in the world. Well, this got in the way. This interfered. We felt that we were being handcuffed, as it were.
Now, actually, the first sound feature ever seen by the public was to be a screen version with singing, but no dialogue, of a hit play of the season. It was to star a great popular entertainer whose voice would now be heard by millions across the country. The only person who was unimpressed was the playwright, Samson Raphaelson, who recalls with very mixed feelings the thought of putting his simple melodrama, The Jazz Singer, into a talking picture.
I remember seeing it. The impact of sound on the public certainly was nothing sensational as I recall it. I mean, people didn't rise en masse and say, wow. They'd heard phonographs. It was just in a new atmosphere. I was completely objective about it. I didn't expect it to be good, except I hoped to get some excitement seeing Jolson on film for the first time, because I then and always have thought Jolson the most electric personality I'd ever encountered. It didn't show through. He loses. He lost then on film, and he always lost on film, and he gradually, you know, he was not a success after 7 or 8 or whatever it is, number of pictures they made.
That was the creator of the original Jazz Singer, playwright Samson Raphaelson, you just heard. October 6, 1927, the New York premiere of the first film where sound, words, and song spoken by a moving shadow on a screen could be heard in the theater. It was fantastic.
The Jazz Singer was to open on a given date.
Now, Albert Housen recalls the time, a day of birth, but also a time of death.
Now, I went to the office in the morning, which was then 1600 Broadway, and had to meet one of our people and go up the street to the theater. I knew Sam Warner was very ill. And as we started out, he said to me, Sam died last night. I said, what are we going to do, postpone the opening? He said, no, Sam wouldn't want us to. We're going ahead. And we walked up the street together to see that everything was prepared for the opening that night. And we did open that night. That, of course, was a sobering influence to us of the organization, but the audience was not aware of it, and it didn't make any difference in their point of view, naturally. So there we were. And, of course, that was the first feature in which any sound was used. And there we had Mr. Jolson singing the various songs that he sang in it and speaking the one line of dialogue that appeared in the picture.
Yes, those were truly prophetic words that broke the motion picture sound barrier in 1927. The picture business literally panicked. And then, with much hesitation, the other studios followed Warner Brothers in ordering these complicated new sound devices. Now, over at Paramount, a young newcomer from New York recalls that sound came in with a dull thud, Mr. Ralph Bellamy.
I was playing opposite Ruth Chatterton. I think she was sitting at the end of a table, and she delivered a speech and rose. And as she did, the boom man had neglected to raise the microphone, and she hit it and with her head, bumped her head on it, and almost knocked her out. She had quite a shock to the extent that they had to get water and smelling salts and all kinds of things. The director was furious, and the sound engineer was operating from a booth around a corner where he couldn't see this operation, came into the set after it had been cut, after the scene had been cut, and the director said, "How was it for you?" sarcastically, and the sound man said, "Well, it came over all right. There was a dull thud at the end, though. I don't know what that was." And here was Miss Chatterton being fanned back to life.
Now, Hollywood sent out a call for help. An SOS, so to speak. And now a migration took place along the old Santa Fe Trail by streamlined train, of course, of people who could talk, teach others to talk and write dialogue, you know, spoken words. One stage personality who could do all three was actor, director, and playwright Elliot Nugent.
Oh, it was still very hectic. They didn't know what they were doing half the time. For instance, microphones were not movable. So that in playing a scene, you had to stop talking when you left the piano and begin again when you got to the fireplace. This made artificial pauses. The mic was hidden in a bowl of flowers on the mantelpiece, and it was hidden in another bowl of flowers on the piano. There was a mic behind the drapes in the window, but you couldn't carry on a scene while you were walking along. They didn't use movable dollies, didn't use movable camera. The camera was in a big, enormous thing called an ice box, insulated for sound. It was bigger than any icebox you ever saw except in a butcher shop.
Now, Elliot Nugent recalling in retrospect the day the screen screamed. "We were all concerned for the silent stars, you know, who were seen and loved but not heard, and who ruled the glamour world in mute splendor. Could they talk?" Now, here's Richard Barthelmess recalling his first sound picture, Weary River, when he talked too much.
This is a story of a convict who composed music and led this prison orchestra. And when he came out of prison, went back into concert stage. And he supposed to have an excellent singing voice as well. So I rehearsed a song called Weary River, which is still remembered by many people. And there was a young radio singer who died recently who stood on the top of the step ladder and sang into a microphone while I sat at the piano and looked up ethereally at him and mouthed the words as he sang them. So I came east, and I stepped off the train at Grand Central, and I was met by the press and representatives from Warner Brothers and one of the established record-making companies with a fat contract for me to sign for making singing records. Well, I didn't know better than to say, well, I didn't sing. Whereupon the press leaked at this, and Warner Brothers was horrified because the Home Office hadn't been afraid of the fact that I hadn't done the singing. They thought they had a little Bing Crosby on their hands. It put me in a little hot water with the press for a minute, and Warner Brothers certainly was shocked, but we overcame that.
Some of us were actually hearing our voices recorded for the first time. Now, you're going to hear the voice of Miss Janet Gaynor, the popular star of Street Angel, Sunrise, and above all, the unforgettable Seventh Heaven. All silence, recalling that momentous first day.
I remember so well we were to go back one night after dinner for our first sound recording. Of course, we worked all day in our own silent way. And we walked into one of the stages, and the whole inside of the set was covered with a brown felt. You know the kind of felt that they put under rugs? That kind of felt. And so you walked in, and of course, you know, your voice, your footsteps, everything was absorbed immediately. So the whole feeling, not only was everyone frightened to death, but then to walk in and not hear anything, this terrible silence. And then whereas you were used to the camera, you were used to the cameraman grinding by hand, you must remember then. So we were used to that noise. When we were on, the minute we heard that, we knew the film was on. And this was our atmosphere. This is really where we functioned the best. And all of a sudden, our camera was in a great box. And no one knew the medium at all. And the man who handled the microphone really didn't know what he was doing. And then the cameraman would call out, no, the mic's in, or the mic shadows. I cannot tell you. These were all new terms to us. Now I had to hear myself, and I just thought, well, this is too awful. But the studio seemed terribly pleased. And I said, how can you be pleased? I thought it was awful, Nathan. Oh, Janet, it's fine because your voice is just right for you. So I said, how fortunate.
Meanwhile, back in Manhattan at the old Manhattan Opera House, two beloved vaudeville stars, Weber and Fields, found the new medium extremely difficult. And Albert Housen recalls...
With Weber and Fields, they did a sketch in which Fields, the taller of the two, wore an opera hat, which, of course, is collapsible. Little Weber wore an ordinary silk hat, high hat, and as they talked, Fields would take off his opera hat and collapse it and stick it under his arm and go on talking, and little Weber would look curiously at Fields and the hat and then feel the top of his own hat and go on talking. Fields would again snap the hat, it would go out and open again, he'd put it on his head, much to Weber's interest and curiosity. Finally, Weber took his own hat off, put it against his fat stomach, and tried to press it to make it go in like Fields' hat had done, without success. He finally got very much annoyed and put the hat on the floor and jumped on it with both feet. Well, his jumping on it with both feet split that hat. It jumped our needles right across what we had previously recorded of their act, thereby ruining all three waxes for the time being. We went over and over and over. I think he must have jumped on a couple of dozen hats. We finally had to cut a hat so that we wouldn't get the explosion caused by his jumping on it. And in that way, we were able to record it without having to re-record.
On still another comedy set, there were changes in personnel and in attitudes as the new medium came in. Notice the introduction of a new member of the producing company, the writer. You know, before sound, of course, there was nothing too much to write down except a few printed titles. And here to tell you about that is Harold Lloyd.
See, in most of our pictures previous to that, story was very secondary. With business that counted. You take like a picture like Safety Last. When we made Safety Last, we did the last part of the picture first. In other words, the last part of the picture was a climb on a building where I scaled a skyscraper building, had a hassle with a clock, in the hands of a clock, until I finally reached the top. And it was quite a thrilling picture, one of our most successful. So we made that first. Now, remember, I didn't know exactly what the beginning of the picture was going to be. Then we sat down with our writers, our gag men, we called them, because we didn't have scripts in these days, remember. We worked without a script. But we went back and we figured how the boy was going to leave his hometown. We knew he was going to do this for the girl, for some reason for the girl. So we worked out all our reasons, and then the picture broke and brought up to the climb.
You've heard a half a dozen film stars who indeed grew up with the movies. From the dreamy, subjective world of wordless acting, or from the stern discipline of the stage, we learned the strange, fragmentary technique of acting in talking pictures. Artistic and technical problems worked themselves out, but some of the personal ones did not. Here are Ralph Bellamy and Reginald Denny, who will speak to you of the beginning of the end for their friend, John Gilbert.
One of the first pictures I made out there was with John Gilbert, who was the matinee idol, of course, of his day. And he had just, when King Pictures came in, MGM, as I got the story, was in the process of financing this new device. And the banks wanted to know who they had. So they quickly made a contract with Jack Gilbert for, it seems to me, three pictures for $2 million over a period of 2 years. But they had neglected to test his voice on the microphone, and he had a very high-pitched voice. So as a result, they were assigning him to anything just to work out the three pictures. And he said to me one day, "I'll clean the spittoons out for the $2 million.
It wasn't John's high voice that wrecked him. In those days, in silent pictures, you had the written title, and you'd have the most flowery, elaborate title. Your eyes are lakes of blue. The thrill within me tells me that those eyes might yet be my downfall. I mean, and in the title, that's all right. Well, when talkies came in, the writers, they had their title writers, they started to write these scripts. And poor John Gilbert, they gave him these abominable lines to read. And with his high, he did have, well, lots of actors today have high-pitched voices. And used in a proper manner, what the devil?
Yes, a great star and a magnetic human being, John Gilbert, the toast of the entire world at that time, just overnight tossed aside in the tumult and the new shouting. The divine days of pantomime were over, finished, and with them the dreams of many attractive youngsters who never had a chance, because after 1927, beauty just wasn't enough.
I remember one of Mary Pickford pictures that we were staging a fashionable tea.
Miss Frances Marion, a scenario writer and a humane observer of Hollywood, adds a footnote to the coming of sound.
The director chose two girls who looked like aristocrats and who were dressed with impeccable taste by the studio's wardrobe department. He said, "Well, now, girls, you're snobs. You exchange a few nasty words with each other at this elegant tea," he stressed. And then the girls preened themselves and they practiced a leisurely walk, but they weren't given any lines to say. And this is what came from them. Said one with a haughty toss of her head, she said, "I seen somebody what was talking about yous the other day." And the other girl came back with, "Oh, was they? It just so happened that they had photogenic faces and figures, and they actually rose to the fringes of stardom."
Screen screamed and is still screaming today in stereophonic, multiple channel, and ultra high fidelity sound. But I don't know, somehow these new devices are no more spectacular than the first amazing moment moving shadows spoke. At least that's the way it seems to me in retrospect. This is Joseph Schildkraut.
This is Myrna Loy again. I must admit that I shared the fright of that first voice test. When Jack Warner led me up to a microphone and said, "All right, now say something." I was with Conrad Nagel, who had a beautifully trained voice, but I had never been on the stage and had had no experience speaking. However, Conrad Nagel spoke to me and I answered. And my first sound picture was The Desert Song, in which I had to dance and also play a wild scene of denunciation. And to top it off, I was playing an Arabian girl and had to speak with an Arabic accent. It was incredible, But I survived somehow. I was one of the fortunate ones. And as the 1920s became the 1930s and people learned how to use sound and how to write for talking pictures, movies became more contemporary and more urbane and less dreamlike. In retrospect, one has the feeling that the movies had entered modern times. Program, we'll take a close look at the great legendary studios that dominated the industry for so many years. Among many others, you'll hear Miss Anita Luce.
Although money was thrown away like crazy, money came in like crazy. I remember that one time I was working on a story with Irving, and we used to wait for story conferences. And sometimes we would wait for 6 weeks, 3 months, 6 months. And while I was waiting, I was knitting a scarf. And by the time the scarf was finished, I figured it had cost MGM about $70,000. And it wasn't a very big scarf at that.
Franco Tone will be our host on my next show, The Film Factory, and it's a good one. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to part 4 of Memoirs of the Movies. Join us again tomorrow at 8:30 as we continue this spoken history of silver screen. Memoirs of the Movies is written and produced by Joan and Robert Franklin, executive producer Bill Kaland. For KFWB, I'm Chuck Walsh.
Memoirs of the Movies, on Tuned to Yesterday, from 1959, a syndicated episode. And that wraps up this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levionier. Thanks for tuning in.